Greetings, all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 205. And in the last lesson, we were in Genesis 49, where Jacob is blessing his sons, and in essence, foretelling the end time future of his children, of his sons, and the entirety, obviously, of the people of God. And in essence, he's also, by prophesying the future of his sons, he's also prophesying many events in the world, because many other nations are going to be affected by whatever blessings are given to Israel. And ultimately speaking, even the entirety of mankind is going to be affected by it. And you have also an impact that is going to be upon this earth for eternity, especially with Judah. In other words, the one that came out of Judah. And so in verse 8, speaking about Judah, we'll recap again here a little bit. He says about Judah, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you are gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as a lioness, who shall rouse him up? In other words, when the lion is ready to attack, who is going to stop him from doing it? Who is going to stop him from devouring, from conquering? And when you see the future of Judah, he displayed that, obviously, for many, many generations. But then came the end in terms of the Second Temple when it was destroyed, and for 2,000 years, Judah was not in that category where he could fight, where he could be a lion. He was not able to have his own land, didn't have obviously armies, and was not in a fighting mood. Was in essence a totally different nature of Judah at that time. It was in total humiliation throughout many countries, not everywhere, but most of the countries. And certainly he was not in this position of a lion. You'd say more unfortunately, and in many occasions, on many occasions he was, you know, in the place of a rat. You know, he was hiding, scared, and constantly going through the afflictions that both religions inflicted upon him, religion of Christianity and Islam. And he was not in all those places in that position that Jacob is talking about. But then he's speaking ultimately, mainly, about the end time of Judah. And in essence, this is what you see. If you go to the book of Zechariah, and we're basically during this time, we're headed toward these very days. We're seeing it all around us. The Middle East is boiling again and exploding. And who knows how it's going to end up. And about this specific time, this is what God is saying about Judah. In Zechariah chapter 12, he's describing the time when Jerusalem, in verse 3, and it shall happen in that day, God says, that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth are gathered against it. Now, obviously, this would have been impossible unless God brought his people Judah first to their land, which he did. And then all this time, he strengthened their hands, and they were like lions, going in all directions, devouring. And the enemies were oftentimes, in all the wars, basically, with the exception of the one in Lebanon, they were defeated, and they certainly recognized in Judah a lion. And you read in Isaiah 19, speaking about Egypt, where the land of Judah shall be a terror to Egypt at that time, and Egypt shall be fearful, of course, for a long time. The people of Egypt, the armies of Egypt, the soldiers of Egypt, whenever they went to war against Israel, you know, the customary retreat was, drop your shoes and run. And oftentimes it happened like that. They were really terrorized by the Israeli soldiers and air force. And obviously things are changing now, because God again is beginning to punish his people, Judah. And so you see more bravery on the part of the enemies of Judah. But still, the lion is still there. It's still very active and very, very lethal in terms of all the nations around it, in terms of what it can still do. And so God said he's going to make Jerusalem that way. And in that day, God himself, in verse 4, he's going to intervene by bringing destruction on the enemies of Judah. In that day, in verse 4, he says the Lord, I will strike every horse with confusion and its rider with madness, and I will open my eyes on the house of Judah, and will strike every horse of the people with blindness. Now, speaking in specific more about what is coming, and not all the exploits of Judah in the past several wars, where God delivered him time and time again from his enemies. And so he's describing the very final battle in one sense, but also what Judah has been in the past 50 years. But in specific, the end time, when the Messiah comes down, and that's the state of Judah. And so we read in verse 5, "And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength in the Lord of hosts, their God." What you find today in Judah is a nation where most of them are secular. Many of them don't even believe in the existence of God. They believe in evolution. And after the Holocaust, many of them gave up the idea of God. They believed, this lie that God is dead. Because they were so traumatized and they could not understand how can God be around and all those things happening to them. And so we find a state in Israel where many are not religious. But there are still many who are religious. And so you see here a reaction to that. The governors of Judah, the leaders, which are mostly secular in nature, atheistic, some of them, they're going to say the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people who are still remaining, and in Jerusalem you find an awful lot of religious people, they're getting, to this state of mind too, where they're going to recognize that, those religious people, after all, do believe in the real God, and that's the real God. And so they're going to say, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength in the Lord of hosts, their God. And in that day, God says, I will make the governors of Judah like a fire pan in the woodpile, and like a fiery torch in the sheaves. And they shall devour all the surrounding peoples on the right and on the left. But Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, Jerusalem. And in specific, it's talking about the fact that in the past many wars, he's been delivering Judah, and they were going right and left and devouring their enemies. But ultimately speaking, what this statement is all about is the end time, the real end time. When he comes down and delivers Judah from their enemies, then he's going to make Judah again like that lion. Because for a period of time, there's going to be a captivity, as you can read in Zechariah 14. But he's going to strengthen Judah, and then you read in Zechariah 14, when he comes down, the Messiah, the Savior, the Deliverer, Jesus Christ, he's going to strengthen Judah, and then we read about Judah. Judah also shall be fighting in that day. So they're not all gone into captivity. Many are still left behind, and the army is still in a fighting force, in a fighting mood. You see, they're not all totally gone. They're going to be devastated, yes. Great calamity is going to fall upon them. He's going to allow them partial victory on the part of the enemy, but only a partial one. Judah, a part of Judah, still will remain, and the line of Judah is not going to be destroyed. And so, this is what he's saying here. They're going to devour all those enemies round about. You read it also in Obadiah, and in Isaiah chapter 11. There you see the house of Judah and the house of Joseph. See, that's the reason why we see so many of the allies, especially the United States, in the Persian Gulf War. And unfortunately, and tragically, as you read in Isaiah 11, you're going to find many of the children of Israel from Joseph, from other Israelites are going to be allied with them against Iraq or other nations. Unfortunately and tragically, many of them are going to be in captivity in those areas in the Middle East. And Isaiah 11 talks about that specifically in the very places where they're going to fall or be captives. They're going to be in Egypt, in Ethiopia, they're going to be in Iraq, in Iran, several places around there. And obviously the people of Judah too, but they're going to fight again. The line of Judah will rise again. And then together with the house of Joseph, they're going to devour. Both you read it in Isaiah 11, Obadiah, and the entirety of the chapter there of Obadiah. And then God says there in verse 8, "In that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The one who is feeble among them in that day shall be like David," and David was a lion. A great lion. He devoured all the nations all around him, right and left, and nobody could withstand him. Nobody could withstand him, that is. And this is going to be repeated again. So David, again, the David, of today, that's what he's saying here. The feeble among them is going to be like David. "And the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them." There are many in Israel, there are many in Jerusalem that are literally of the house of David, and many of them know their identity. They know that they are of the royal line of David. And many there who live in Jerusalem. And so this is what God is going to do then for them. And then verse 9, it shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And at the same time, he said in verse 10, I will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Yes, speaking about the house of David that is right there in Jerusalem. Many of them, you know, came back there. And many of them, as I said, know their identity. And so their identity is going to be even more open and clear to many, especially when the two witnesses are there for 2, 3.5 years. They certainly are going to reveal an awful lot of secrets. And there's going to be a lot of knowledge and information. But anyway, the line of Judah is going to rise again. So when Jacob is describing here Judah as a lion's whelp, and mind you, in the beginning he was saying, I'm going to tell you what's going to be your end time future. This is what you see now, in specific, about this time. And so when it says, Judah is a lion's whelp, from the prey, my son, you are gone up. He stooped down, he crouched, as a lion and as a lioness, who shall rouse him up? And so you see a direct fulfillment here of this. And obviously, Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Judah, he is the ultimate lion. You know, he's called the lion of the house of, you know, the tribe of David, of the house of David, or the tribe of Judah. You see? And so that's what he's talking about here. And then verse 10, he continues, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, and has not to this very day, even though they don't have kings in Judah, but they have kings over the nations of Israel, that is, rulers, be it the royal house in Britain, or all the royal houses in Europe. And who knows how many of the prime ministers in other countries of Europe where they don't have kings and rulers there are of the house of Judah, because you see their emblems and have been there in all these northwestern European countries all these many centuries. Some of Judah remained there. And those who reigned over the French people, Charlemagne and all those people there, they were all from that house of Judah. You know, the Merovingian and many others. And so this is what you find today, and also in the United States, those who care to investigate that, many of the leaders of the presidents of the top echelons in the United States are all linked to the royal house in Britain, which obviously is linked to the royal house of David. And so you see the fulfillment of the prophecy, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. In other words, rulers shall always be there. As long as we read it earlier, this is a mistranslation here. In other words, until Shiloh comes. That's the correct translation. That means until the Messiah comes. Shiloh means the gift of God. Shiloh, or Shiloh Adonai. In other words, the gift of God. And unto him, you know, unto him, the gift of God, who is the ultimate lion of Judah, and unto him shall the obedience of the peoples be. And that's what we read in Zechariah 12, and also in Zechariah 14. And so you see, Judah is in that position of rulership and has been there for the longest time, even though much of Judah as a nation, as a people, was downtrodden for 2,000 years. Yet God made a promise to David that there are always going to be rulers that will come of him to rule over the house of Israel. And not only that, he even mentioned all the children of Abraham. So that includes even the Arabs and many others. And you could see, Britain in the ancient times. You know, it's ancient history, not to many people, but only a century, 2 centuries ago, where they ruled over, even at the beginning of the last century, 19th, they reigned over the Middle East, over Africa, many other places, North Africa, where, between them and the French people, where the children of Abraham are. And so you see fulfillment of that. And the house of David, that is, the royal kingdom there in Britain and many other places, they reigned over those territories. They were in charge of that in other places. So you see fulfillment here of a prophecy of an end time. And if you want to go to Psalm, let's go to Psalm 60 and verse 7, where God has a little bit to say here about Judah, the state of Judah, the way he meant for Judah to be in terms of rulership. And so we read in Psalm 60 and verse 7, where God is speaking here. In verse 6, God has spoken in his holiness, I will rejoice, I will divide Shechem. Shechem, that's a shoulder, and it's interesting There is a city in the West Bank called Shechem, Nablus today, an Arab town. And to this very day, they have a lot of problems there. A lot of rioting there, intifada and all that stuff. God says, I'm going to divide Shechem and measure out the valley of Sukkot. Gilead is mine, that's the East Bank, and here it is, the Jordanians occupy that, and yet they call the Israeli the aggressors who have taken the occupied territories of the Arabs on the West Bank. When God says, even the East Bank is mine, he says, Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine, and that territory was given to Manasseh. And so ironically, the American people are so blind and ignorant, they don't even know their ancestry, their heritage, they don't know where they came from. And modern America, they've got a lot of people who don't even know what happened 20 years ago, including many politicians and leaders at the top. So God says, you know, the East Bank, in essence, in modern terminology, is mine. It belongs to Manasseh. Ephraim also is a helmet for my head, and Judah is my lawgiver. You see? So what Jacob is saying here, that the scepter, you know, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, in other words, the scepter shall never depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. And that's what he's talking about also. Judah remained the lawgiver. And when he had the leaders from Judah reigning over the house of Israel, the entirety of all the nations of Israel, many other places too, well, they find the lawgiver that never departed from Judah. And they reign over many peoples, even though as a nation, as Jews, you know, they are not recognized as the ones in charge today. But ultimately they are going to be, because you are going to see a reality where Jesus Christ from the house of Judah, the tribe of Judah, the line of Judah, well, he's the creator, but he came from Judah, not from Ephraim, Manasseh, or anybody else, certainly not from Edom or Ishmael or others. And he's the ultimate ruler. Under him you're going to find King David, line of Judah, tribe of Judah, you see, reigning over all the nations of Israel that will be gathered back to their land. And then you find all the apostles, all Jews, you see, reigning over every single one of the tribes of Israel. And so, you know, when you study this kind of prophecies, you know, you put all things together and you begin to realize the magnificent statements that Jacob was making here. And in essence, God is the one making the statements. And he's prophesying the future because he's the one who is going to bring it to pass. And he's the one that is going to be personally involved in it. And he's going to be the one that is going to fulfill those things, becoming, as time went by, you know, 2,000 years ago, a son of Judah, a son of David. And so this is what we read here. And then in verse 11, binding his foal unto the vine, and his ass is called unto the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine, and his vesture in the blood of grapes. And his eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk. And we alluded to that. We began reading statements that God made in Isaiah 63. Let's go through another verse here while we are in the Psalms. In Psalm 108, in verse 8, where God had something else to say about Judah. And this is what you read here in Psalm 8, about the future of Judah that Jacob was talking about. Again, repeating the same statement as we just read, Gilead is mine. And it's interesting, the same statement, you know, from verse 7, God has spoken in his holiness, I will rejoice. So in essence, God repeated that very statement twice, word for word, in Psalm 60 in verse 7, in Psalm 108 in verse 8. And so now we're back to Isaiah 63, where we read the first few scriptures. And, you know, you link that with this statement about blood, about wine, about garments, you see. And Jesus Christ, who is speaking now through Jacob, is going to bring it to pass, and he himself becomes a part of the picture here. And as we read here, he washed his garments in wine. And so, as we read, and we'll repeat that again here in Isaiah 63, to maintain the continuity, Isaiah 63 and verse 1, who is this who comes from Edom? And Edom, what does Edom mean? Red, you see? That's the people of Edom, the twin brother of Jacob. His name is Red. And God says, who is this who is coming from Red? You see? From the land of the red people, and he's going to link it with the fact that when he walks all over Edom, which is red, he's going to get red. That means his clothes are going to get red. And it's interesting, you know, in Hebrew you see the link here. Of course, in English you lose it. Edom means red, and his apparel, because of the wine or the blood, you know, wine is just symbolic of the blood, and as he himself made it clear in his own blood, And so the two are linked, and that's why we drink the wine, you know, because the two are linked, symbolic of each other. And so who is this that comes from Edom, or Ed, with dyed garments from Bosra, dyed with red, that is. And Bosra, as I mentioned earlier, that's today the capital of Iraq, the oil capital in the Persian Gulf, because as I mentioned before several times, the people of Edom anciently went in that direction, and Iraq is one of the major nations of Edom, at least in the Middle East, that's the major nation of Iraq, and of course Shigdom surround it, and other places, and the others went to other areas, as covered up in that series on Edom. And so, this is what he's talking about here. And again, who is this who comes from Edom with the dyed garments from Bosra? This one who is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Now the prophet is asking him, looking at him and seeing his appearance. He says, why is your apparel red? You see, why is it, you know, full of blood? And he comes from Edom, and Edom means red, and red is blood. He says, why is your apparel red? And your garments like one who treads in the winepress. And, you know, in the old days, you know, there's still people who do it. They take all the vine, you know, that is all the grapes, and they put it in those vats, and you know, they step over it until, you know, the juice comes out. And obviously, you know, all of your clothes become red because of that. That is red wine, red grapes, obviously. And that's where the prophet sees him, and he's asking him, why is it so? And he says, I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me, for I have trodden them in my anger and trampled them in my fury. Their blood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I have stained all my robes. And all that is happening, obviously, at the end time, for the day of vengeance, verse 4, is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. And so when Jacob is making this statement, he's referring to that. You see, he says the scepter shall not depart from Judah until you know, in essence, the Messiah comes. And when the Messiah comes, unto him all the obedience of the people shall be. Why? Because he stepped all over them. You see? That's why then, you know, the next statement is in verse 11, binding his foal unto the vine, and his ass is called unto the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his vesture in the blood of grapes. You see? I know, but by itself it doesn't mean anything, you know. When do you ever, you know, you don't see Judah doing that. But in essence, he's describing the Lion of Judah. See, when Judah went to war, when he destroyed all of his enemies round about. And when the ultimate happens, because now that's in the context of the Shiloh that comes, the Messiah. So it's more linked, you know, this statement to the Messiah than to Judah himself. But in essence, it's linked to Judah because the Messiah is of the line of Judah, of the tribe of Judah. And so these two statements are linked here. And you go to the book of Revelation, and you see that again, because in Revelation, God again is repeating that in chapter 15. We read in, chapter 14. And you read in verse 19, again, this is speaking about the time when God is going to pour his punishment. And he's obviously also using angels here with the sickle, you know, and reaping the harvest. And you read in verse 19, so the angel thrust his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trampled outside the city. And blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. And that's exactly what God describes. When he comes down, when the Messiah comes down in Zechariah 14, you read about that. He's going to come down. Obviously, his angels are coming with him. You know, as Jude spoke about the angel coming, and 10,000 saints with him, and Moses spoke about the same thing. So he's coming down with his, you know, he's the chief of staff of the armies of God, so to speak, the Lord of hosts, that's what it means. And he comes down with the holy angels, and then also the saints, as they ascend to meet him in the air, they come down. The first thing they do, the first order of the day, is go to war. You see? And all that happens, obviously, before the wedding supper that comes after that. Because the law of God is that when you get married, you don't go to war. And so obviously this war is happening before the wedding. Even though they rise up to you know, in the air to meet him, as they come down, the first thing that happens is war. After that, when all the enemies are subdued, then he can sit down and, you know, and plan your wedding supper. And so this is what you see here again. And then let's go to Revelation 21, no, actually Revelation 19, Revelation 19, you read in verse 11, "Now so heaven opened, and behold a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war." Again, the same terminology, because this is what is happening here. And Jesus Christ, the Shiloh that Jacob talks about, is coming down and he makes war, the Lion of Judah. And his eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. And now he's been coronated, and he had a name written that no one knows except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, just like Isaiah describes here. And there is in the connection and linking it to the war against Edom, the war against Babylon and other places. It's the same. Because Bostra is in Babylon today, and as we mentioned that in the series about Edom, the two are linked. And not only here, not only the Middle East, but also in Europe, because those people migrated. And then he says, "And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses." So again, he comes down, you know, whenever Christ comes down on his traveling throne. This time, he doesn't come on the traveling throne, because whenever he goes to war, he always comes on a horse, riding on a horse, riding to battle. So this is the battle fatigue that he's coming with here. And the armies in heaven were with him, and they're all clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. "Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron, and he himself treads the winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of Almighty God." And so, you know, when you read all these things, you know, you go to Isaiah 11, you read the same thing, you know, when God is going to deliver his people Israel and Judah, then he's going to put them to war, but he's going with them also. In Psalm 2 also, when he reads about, you know, the nations that are raging against God and he's anointed, you see, and he's going to bring destruction on them. And so when you read in Isaiah 63, about more details there, that's what it's talking about. And here it is in Revelation. And all that is linked way back into what Jacob here, inspired by God, the one that became his son, through his son Judah, is saying these very words. That's talking about 3,700 years before it happens. And so when he talks here about the Shiloh that comes, the Christ that comes, the Messiah, the gift of God, and then all people are going to obey him, well, obviously, he's going to crush them, rule them with a rod of iron, and in the process, you know, as he crushes them, verse 11 becomes a reality, binding his foal unto the vine and his ass is colt unto the choice vine. In other words, you know, sort of a description, you know, you bind the colt, then you go to war, you get off the colt, and then you go to war. You know, you fight them. Hand-to-hand combat, so to speak. And he washes his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. And so this has in essence, and obviously, both meaning, physical and spiritual. Spiritual in the sense that it's talking about war, and physical in the sense also that you know, Judah, like all the others, is going to be abundantly blessed physically. He's going to have vineyards and lots of wine. But obviously you see that since this is very, you know, being linked directly with verse 10 about Shiloh coming, you see the connection there between the two. So it's speaking more about that spiritual reality. And so in verse 12 he says, "And his eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk." And so when eyes are red with wine, you know, you talk about anger and fury and wrath. And really, you know, this description, you know, fits more. Not only Judah is going to fight the enemies, you know, that persecuted him grievously, as they're doing now, just beginning. But ultimately speaking, the Lion of Judah, the Messiah. As I said many times, you know, he's going to be so furious and his anger will go to his face, and so your eyes become red, so to speak. And that's what he's talking about. And so let's continue now with after that with Zebulun in verse 13. "Zebulun shall dwell at the seashore." And he did anciently in the land of Israel, but then ultimately, as he went into northwest Europe, obviously that's where you find them, the Dutch people, and it shall be a shore for ships. And in Rotterdam, you know, which is the biggest port in the world, this is where you find the Dutch people. "And his flank shall be upon Zidon," that's anciently, he was in that area, and in Zidon were the Phoenicians, the red people, the people of Edom, that is the ones that are taken over from their former Hittites that were there, and Canaanites, the Hamitic races. But Edom took over, the red people, and, you know, those people, for a period of time, just like they do now and then in history, lived in peace with the children of Israel, and so they all were in that business of seafaring. And so, we read here in verse 15, "For he saw a resting place that it was good, and of the land that it was pleasant, and he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant under task work. And anciently, you know, he lived in a territory that was a fertile area, and then obviously in the future, where he traveled into Northwest Europe and ended up in Holland, he ended up in the territory that is also a farming territory, which he himself had to carve with his own hands out of the sea. So, you know, he became a servant to the land, and he bowed his shoulder, you know, to bear, because, you know, that's what he needed. He didn't have enough land. And obviously, I'm not going to spend much time here on this section in terms of prophecy, where they went, the tribes of Israel, and things like that. That would be too much here. You'll have to go to other sources for that. There are plenty there. There is much information among the people of God who know these things. And so you see this reality here. Basically, you know, the tribes of Israel, as Jacob is prophesying here by inspiration from God, and many other sources can show us this very things, and migrated ultimately after the captivity by the Assyrians into Northwest Europe, among other places. These are not the only places they went to. And so this prophecies cannot be understood unless you know this whole history of Israel and their migrations and where they went. Then he goes to Dan, verse 16. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. And Dan became, just like Judah, a low giver. And when you look at the history of Dan, and it's very well known, the people of Dan went to Greece, anciently, and they, in essence, became the low givers there. They became the elite there. The Greeks actually wanted them to rule over them. They had those qualities. And then they went to Denmark and the British, that is Ireland. And you see out of Dan, you know, there were many people, not only there, but those who came to the Americas, and those even, you know, some of them that remained in Europe. Sprinklings of them, obviously. You see those qualities there, you know, lots of the judges, of the policemen, of teachers are of the tribe of Dan. And everybody knows ancient Samson, you know, the Danite, the judge of Israel. And that's what he's talking about here. And verse 17, Dan shall be a serpent. That's another description of Dan. A serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path. In other words, he's describing the migratory customs of Dan, just like a snake. Wherever he goes, he leaves a path there behind. And basically, wherever he went, he left names behind to signify that he was there. And so you find a lot of names in Europe and other places where he went. You know, the Danube, Dnieper, Dniester, you know, Denmark, you know, the Mark of Dan. And then, you know, London, you know, you find all this Dan all over the place. And they come, you know, this D-N in Hebrew, obviously no vowels in Hebrew. They come either in the beginning of the word, you know, the end, the middle, here and there. Anyway, this is what he did. That's what he's talking about here. And Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path, that bites the horse's heel, so that his rider falls backward. And specific in terms, Jacob is specifically speaking here in terms of the end time, obviously he's talking about the constant struggles that he has with his brother Ephraim. You know, you see this Irish unending, constant strife there, and conflict and bickering, you know, between the two brothers. This is a description of it. And verse 18, he adds a statement here that seems to be a little bit strange. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Speaking about Dan, and some people, you know, try to come up with all kind of understanding of what it really means. And, you know, it could be anybody's guess. You know, some people say that because he became, you know, anciently Dan was known as an expert in the black magic. You know, you see a lot of superstition in Ireland, and leprechauns and all those things. And therefore, he strayed away so far from God, even though, you know, they're in the Catholic religion, where they supposedly believe in God and things like that, but they're more into superstition than anything else. And some people think, well, maybe that's a reason for it. In either case, one of these is going to find out exactly what it means. And some look at into the list of the tribes, that is, of the people, among the 144, and they don't find the tribe of Dan there, and they think, well, Dan is going to be out of it. Well, the reality is that when you look into the city of Jerusalem and the division of the land, Dan is going to be there, and one of the gates of Jerusalem is going to be after the name of Dan. And heaven in Jerusalem, when it comes down, one of the gates is after Dan. You know, so let's, you know, we don't need to go too far with these guesses that we have. Something we'll have to wait until we fully understand what it means. Verse 19, Gad, a troop shall... And Gad in Hebrew means literally troop. Gad, Gdud, you know, battalion in Hebrew. And so, you know, in English you miss it, but Gad and troop are the same word in Hebrew. Gad is a troop, shall, and that is a troop
shall be upon him, but he shall troop upon their heel. You know, the play on word that he can do it in Hebrew, but he cannot do it in English, and that's why they translated it here in this way, so you can get a little bit of the meaning of here. So the way they wrote it in Hebrew is this way: Gad, which means a troop, and then it says a troop, which means Gad, shall troop upon him, but he shall troop upon their heel. So Gad, you know, became a mighty in war, and very, very good soldiers. And some people believe today that Gad is in Belgium, and you know, they have good though they're not very much fighting force, but they have very good soldiers there, good quality soldiers, and they have been known also as being good soldiers even in the days when they were in the land of Israel, on the East Bank with Ephraim. That is, not Ephraim, Manasseh and Reuben, side by side with Reuben mostly. Very fine soldiers. So that could be related to that. Verse 20, as for Asher, his bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties. And some people that trace the migration of Asher, they say that a part of Asher went to Italy, southern Italy, where they have a lot of olives, and you know, the Etruscan area, that were people of Asher, as some say. John Wilson, and then when was that? 1940. He wrote something about that. But anyway, we're not going to cover the migratory future of children of Israel here. But you know, for those who have some information about that, you can link the two together and find that out. After all, we're having a study of the law here, and now and then we take some forays into other areas. But we need to stick more to the law; otherwise, we'll never finish. And so for those who are interested in more information, there is a lot of information out there about the tribes of Israel. And in verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful vine by a fountain. Its branches ran over the wall. And obviously, in ancient Israel, you see Joseph having, in essence, three portions. Because Manasseh had two portions, one on the west bank, one on the east bank of the Jordan. And so it's sort of running over in that way, but that's not the ultimate that Jacob was talking about, because he was talking about the end time. So much of this prophecy has to do with the end time. And so he says, the archers have dealt bitterly with him and shot at him and hated him, but his bow abode firm, and the arms of his hands were made supple by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. When you understand, the areas into which Joseph migrated, not only into the west, but mainly into the west, northwest Europe, British Isles, from there to the Americas, Australia, New Zealand, and all those kind of places, South Africa, you begin to understand this prophecy of what it really means. And so he said he had so much to say about Joseph, and so did Moses, because obviously the birthright was given to him, and so the future would really see this reality fulfilled in a greater way. And that's what we've experienced in the past many centuries, and especially in the last couple of centuries, and even in this end time, the land of Joseph, and especially today Manasseh, America. Of course, there are some people that think the other way around. Ephraim, they say, is in America, and Manasseh is in Ephraim, that is in Britain. But you see Joseph at a very, very high position. And this scripture basically reflect that. And so he says in verse 22, in verse 24 again, but his bow abode firm, and the arms of his hands were made supple. And you study the history of these two peoples of Joseph, ancient history, modern history, in between, you see all these things as a reality. And so his hands were made supple by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, for thence from the shepherd, the stone of Israel. And much has been said about the stone of Israel that ended up in Britain, the royal house of Britain, that is using it for coronation. Verse 25, even by the God of your father who shall help you, and by the Almighty who shall bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath. In other words, mineral resources, blessings from above, with nice weather, good land, a lot of children. All those things have been fulfilled in the migrating tribes of Joseph that came to the British Isles. Part of them remained, a few of them sprinklers in Europe, and many of them, a minority, but still many, there are millions of them, actually in faraway places. And northern India, and northern border of China, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kurdistan, and all those territories up there, some of the republics, and many of them who still know their identity. They even know their identity in terms of the tribe. not only as Israelites, they never lost it, ironically, because they remained together all this time and never, generally speaking, mingled among the other nations. And so, this is talking about that. And then some of them have a lot of blessings there too. There's an area in India called Manipur, and there are about 5 million of them that claim to be children of Israel, and, you know, from the Joseph, Manasseh, and things like that. Very fertile area. And they are very, you know, very well-to-do people, though not all of them are doing extremely well. Verse 26, the blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my progenitors, and unto the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of the prince among his brethren. And so, Jesus Christ, the God of Israel, is the one speaking here, and obviously speaking by the end time that he's going to bring upon his own people, Joseph, and the rest of the tribes of Israel. And so, we continue here, and this is it that their father spoke unto them and blessed them. Everyone, according to his blessing, he blessed them. And it's interesting, he had all the tribes, he spoke about all the tribes before that, and then he left Joseph to the end, and for him he spent the majority of his discourse here of the foretelling of their future. Though Joseph became the first, he left him for the last here to speak about, and he concentrated on his future. And he charged them and said unto them, verse 29, I am to be gathered into my people, bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. But mind you, Abraham bought it, even though it belonged to Ephron the Hittite, in that field. He bought it from him. He didn't buy the whole field. He bought, you know, land around it, obviously. And so it was still known throughout the area as the field of Ephron the Hittite. In the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham brought with the field, that is, there was a field around it, from Ephron the Hittite for a possession of burying place. And that place is still there to this very day, and they have a lot of problems there, obviously. And there are some Jews that want to remain close by, and that creates a lot of friction with them and the Arabs, you know, all claim descent from Abraham. And recently there was a desecration of the tomb of Joseph, and of course America, Britain, you know, they're totally unaware of their ancestor, their forefathers, the patriarch Joseph, so they did not even pay much attention to it. Had they known who that person is, which they're going to be aware of in the future, they certainly would have done something about it. And in the future they will. That's a part of their, you know, their heritage. Verse 31, there they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife, there they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife, and there I buried Leah, the field and the cave that is therein. And it's interesting, Rachel was not buried over there because she died earlier before they arrived to that place, and they did not bring her bones to this place, because in those days, you know, once you bury someone, that's it, that's where he stays. And so Leah died in that area, and so she was buried there. And the field and the cave that is therein, which was purchased from the children of Heth. And when Jacob made an end of charging his sons, he gathered up his feet unto, that is, into the bed, and, you know, English, expired. Died, in other words. And was gathered unto his people. You know, an idiom to means that where his people are, in the grave. Not that, you know, they're in heaven and he went to heaven with them. No, where they're in the grave, he went there with them. That's where he's dwelling. Not alive, but that's a physical terminology, where, you know, where your grave is, you know, where your fathers are, in the land of the fathers. And so, he was gathered unto his people at this point, but obviously later on he was buried with his people. And as David would say, but his son that died, you know, that where he goes I cannot come, I'll go to him, but he cannot come to me. In other words, he's in the grave and I'll go to the grave, but he cannot come back to me. And some people, you know, as time went by, even in the Jewish community, and that happened after the Second Temple era, they began to believe that Babylonian, Egyptian doctrine of heaven and hell and life after death, and so they gave it totally different interpretation. Anyway, we're going to stop at this point, and this is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.